This is episode number 18 of the Bearded Marketers Podcast, the only internet marketing podcast that matters. We do weekly episodes. I think they drop every Monday mornings. You can find us on iTunes or thebeardedmarketers.com.
Or even Stitcher, we're on that as well. So feel free to reach out to us on any of those outlets. Give us a rating and a like and share it with your friends. We'd greatly appreciate it.
Also, we also appreciate voicemails and texts to 904-270-9603. Comments, questions, love stories, complaints. It doesn't matter. We want it all.
Missed connections.
Those are probably the best. First, we'd like to start off talking about what we're drinking for the night before we get into the topics. What are you drinking tonight?
All right, so for me tonight, I'm drinking a spicy margarita. Mm. And this is consisted of Rob the Alchemist in the kitchen created a pepper-infused tequila with lime and Contro. It is quite tasty. A little bit of burn on the back end, but oh, so nice for a summer drink. What about you?
I'm going with a Moscow Mule. Anything with ginger beer to me is good. It's just vodka and ginger beer, a little bit of lime.
Any ginger beer?
No. There's only one kind of ginger beer that matters, and it's Gosling's.
If you'd like to send us a case for promoting your ginger beer, we'd greatly appreciate it.
Preferably Gosling's. The diet version.
All right, so enough of that. We're going to tweet out those recipes later on if you'd like to give them a try. And maybe I'll even tweet out a picture of this pepper-infused tequila we're talking about, and okay. You can see the crazy concoctions Rob comes up with. So for tonight's episode, we're going to be talking about some new research coming out from the Washington Post about above-the-fold ads and what they are finding with how we need to maybe rethink our ad placements and how people behave on websites. We're also going to be talking about stats on mobile ads and changes in that area, and actually some interesting stats that might affect the placements that you might want to be purchasing or the devices that you're going to be targeting.
Yeah, and for those not in the know, Gmail has actually rolled out a new design for their online email interface, and we're going to look at some of the maybe implications on open rates for that new design and how it's going to affect sends in the future for people doing email campaigns. And then we're also going to take a look at negatives as positives. What does that mean?
Question mark.
We're leaving it at that.
Vague. All right, so let's start things off above the fold. Now, anytime you bring up above the fold, and I put that in air quotes, it brings up a lot of strong feelings in people. You know, a lot of people have a lot of opinions about above the fold. How much does it matter? Is it a must? If you want people to engage, does it have to be above the fold? You know, in my personal experience, I've done a lot of testing around above the fold. And I think that what a lot of people miss is understanding what you're trying to do above the folds, what other elements are on the page and what you're trying to accomplish, really the complexity of what you're trying to accomplish on that page. I mean, a lot goes into above the fold. And I feel like personally it's a loaded term. But what I found in testing more often than not, and what's more important than I find than the statement above the fold, is having engaging content and connecting with the visitor quickly on the page to help them progress and understand how does this page work? How do I need to move through this content? And also it's relevant to me that I understand where I'm at. It looks believable. I trust it. And now I want to move forward. So having said all that, we ran across some research that the Washington Post is about to come out with and publish where they took the time to really research and perform some tests on ads with their site. As many of you probably know by now, the newspaper industry is kind of struggling in this online space.
No,
and,
no.
You know, they're trying to understand and develop ways where they can actually make money online and continue their services. Because to develop good content on a newspaper level does take a lot of money. I mean, if you want to have correspondents, if you want to have real reporters, these types of things cost money, and when you want to have strong quality control over your content, there is a big difference between blog news and things like the Drudge Report and other types of, you know, blog news sites. And someone like the Washington Post that has a lot more production into the content that they generate and just more overhead costs, and they're really struggling with, you know, more people are reading our information and consuming our content online, but how do we still be able to maintain this high quality and make enough money to where we can support this and keep up our own internal quality that we want to with our content? So a lot of that is driven by ads. There's other subscription models and things that come into play and sponsored ads and things like that, which we won't get into, but ads for newspapers and news sites in general is a big business. So it's how a lot of them make, you know, significant portions of their monies that they need to survive. So it is in Washington Post's interest to understand how people behave on landing pages and content and interact with ads. And so they specifically looked at what does above the fold mean when it comes to the ad space. And one of the first things that they kind of found as they observed people's behavior was, depending on the design of the page, what they found is a lot of users actually scroll pretty quickly when they arrive to the page to get to the content. And for them, that was a big learning point because many news sites and just sites in general have kind of top placement ads. If you do buy ads as a marketer, you'll know that ads typically higher up on the page are more expensive. That's kind of premium real estate. And what they found in their research is for their site in particular, they were finding that a lot of people, when they arrive on a landing page or a page loads, the user would do a quick scroll farther down the page. And so what they were finding is some of their top placement ads, you know, might have technically had an impression load, but the user really didn't see that ad. And what implication that means for the Washington Post is if they're selling this as a premium spot and charging a premium rate, how do we get people to actually look at these ads and how do we evaluate that? So they did some tests where they, instead of having a static ad at the top, they created an element that would actually follow you for 7 seconds on load as you drifted down the page, and then the element would return back to the top. And what they found in testing is, in some cases, over a 31% increase in engagement with the ad over control versus elements that just stayed technically above the fold the whole time. And they also tested some other things, and I feel like I've been talking a little bit, so I kind of wanted to get your opinion on that. But, you know, I think that they are kind of mixing the pot, so to say. I mean, I think you are somewhat testing above the fold, but having an element that follows someone around the page is also a different element altogether. So I don't know if that's necessarily a fair comparison to say, well, above the fold is dead because we tested it versus this element that follows you around and that one did better, so above the fold doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think What's happening here is a lot of different sort of ideas are being confused at the same time when they sort of make these overarching statements, which I think we've seen in the past from some of these larger companies doing research.
Well, it's link bait at the end of the day. I mean, it gets people to click through.
Exactly. And so I think it depends on what you mean when you say over, so above the fold, and there we're talking about engagement. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe a lot of brands aren't necessarily looking for clicks. They're just looking for brand impressions.
Sure.
It depends on how they're charging customers, too. If they're charging more based on impressions, which is usually how banner ads are sort of priced, then obviously the advertisers are maybe looking for a different sort of incentive. Again, maybe they're just looking for brand impressions instead of clicks, whereas some advertisers may be paying for impressions but ultimately wanting clicks, and it's not backing out for them. They're not getting the clicks from the spend, so it doesn't make sense for them to buy those above-the-fold ads. And maybe the Washington Post is speaking to those people and maybe not necessarily the brand advertisers, because this doesn't necessarily seem to be measuring people's maybe sort of awareness that there was an ad there. I mean, yes, they may have sort of scrolled past it pretty quickly, but they may have still maybe been aware that it was there if it was just like a pretty clean ad with a logo on it or something like that. So I think that's maybe one element, but I think it brings into sort of the forefront that, you know, when you purchase ads on sites, media buys like this, Washington Post, I mean, it's probably fairly expensive. It's not just about paying for those spots and thinking about which can we afford and which fits in the budget. It's looking at the pages themselves and saying, what kind of designs can I put in these spots that are maybe going to attract attention and get clicks? It's not about trying to get a million impressions above the fold. It's, we have a really good ad that performs well, and it really fits in at maybe the bottom of the page where people are trying to comment on an article, and that's going to be really high performing for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what a lot of people don't take into account with their media buys is, You know, especially when you're going after some large sites, potentially like the Washington Post or, you know, sites that are going to provide you quite a bit of impressions, that it behooves you to spend a little bit of time and understand, where is my ad going to appear and what is going to be the best design for that, to where we're going to be able to reap the benefits of not only the exposure that we're going to get, but also the attention that we can garner. And I think that's also something that gets lost in the study that they talk about. If you look at the Washington Post design, you know, some of the ads that get displayed at the top feel kind of orphaned. And, you know, I don't think that past a page or two of engagement, I even pay attention to that anymore. And I'm kind of conditioning my users to scroll down pretty quickly to engage in my content, which I also think is something that they don't point out, is I think design also influences the behaviors that you're instructing users to do. You know, if I, as a user, engage with a couple of your pages and you have a huge nav element and you have a big ad at the top and you also usually have a big image in the article, well, I'm kind of conditioned as I'm absorbing your content that I need to immediately kind of scroll down a little bit when the page loads to get into the content that I actually click through and engage with. So think about the design of the site. I mean, the big takeaway for us in this study was really, you know, when you're potentially doing media buys, spend a little bit of time, understand the design of the sites that you're going to try to do some buys for, what ad is going to stick out, and where might be the best place for the content that you're actually targeting and the audience as well. And I think that above the fold doesn't necessarily matter as much when you take into account what is going to be the design of the page and also your media elements as well. So take those into account. So moving on and keeping in the, I guess, ad world for a little bit, you were reading an interesting study on some stats with mobile ads, click-through rates, conversions that differ quite a bit depending on what OS that you're on.
Right. So, you know, I don't mean to harp on it, but obviously mobile is huge now. It used to be social was the thing everybody's talking about, but mobile is the thing. Laptops and computer sales are down, I think it's like 20% over last year. People are more and more using phones and iPads to interact with things. And with that comes, you know, obviously buying ads either from websites themselves for mobile users or from actually in apps that people use on their phones and iPads. I think for a while now, people have been, you know, maybe interacting with some of this stuff, but haven't been giving it the full attention that I think it deserves.
Sure.
I think I have some stats here that can help people make some better decisions on media buys in particular. Where should they be doing it? Apps, websites, what kind of ads, what kind of formats? So there's a study that was done by one of the larger, I guess, media buying platform companies out there. It's called Opera MediaWorks. They included something like 370 million ad impressions, something like that. So a pretty large chunk, and they have some pretty good stats across a wide variety of different platforms. So it's not just like all iPhone users or all Android users, something like that. It's a pretty wide variety in there. So they found some interesting things, and I just want to run through some of those stats. So one of the primary things they looked at in this was standard ads versus sort of animated ads. And I think more and more that I use apps, the more and more I see animated ones come through, and it seems obvious on the surface that they probably perform better. And so their stats have sort of reinforced that. You get 1.7 times more clicks on a rich media ad than you would a standard ad.
So by rich media, you mean something that's animated?
Something that's moving.
Okay.
And, you know, what I usually see, I'm, you know, using more apps on my phone now than I have been in the past. And what I see oftentimes are ads that look like notifications. So, I mean, obviously, right, exactly. Obviously, those get tons of clicks. Ads that look like download and install buttons, things like that. So in-app ads that are animated obviously perform much better than sort of static ones that I think a lot of people sort of just churn out to just get ads out there.
Right, or that's kind of recycled from other campaigns.
Right.
You know, like a static ad might be fine on a normal website, but in an app, there's usually a lot of motion, a lot of things going on, and you are kind of competing for that attention. And so something that's animated, or some might argue a little bit more of a nefarious design where you're making it look like a notification, is going to compete better against that attention and get people's eyes on it more.
So sort of on in that same vein, similarly, ads purchased in app perform roughly 2 times as well as ads purchased from a website.
Okay.
So sort of going by the, you know, we're doubling everything now. If you are buying ads in mobile platforms, I mean, obviously rich media and app ads are going to perform the best. So let's now talk about some platforms and different monetization strategies and how those sort of play out. Looking at their platform, when you compare iPhone and Android, they had both roughly the same coverage. So a fair percentage.
You mean like number of impressions?
Right.
Okay.
Same number of impressions for Android or iPhone, both in-app and online. What's interesting, though, is that iPhone revenue, sort of clicks, interaction, things on iPhone was roughly twice as much as on an Android phone. So I wanted to talk to you maybe about what that sort of implies.
Mm-hmm.
And is it from necessarily the users that use iPhones clicking more ads? Or is it a combination of that plus advertisers willing to spend more money on iPhone users and get in front of their face? And I have a feeling it's probably definitely a combination of the two.
Mm-hmm.
But it could just be that maybe iPhone users are suckers for clicking on ads. I don't know.
True. I mean, I think to preface it, you are part of the evil Apple Corporation group, and then I use Android personally. Both have their merits, so I don't want to feel like I'm on an Apple hate train. But, you know, I think that what's maybe driving the strats, like you talked about, is a couple different things. For a long time, Apple far and away was the money pot when it comes to mobile ad buys and development. If you wanted to make money with mobile phones or tablets, Apple was the way to go. Android has been making up quite a bit of ground, and I've seen a lot of research lately that puts development revenues neck and neck now with Android devices. So I think that part of it is, for such a long time, there was so much money and effort poured into Apple because it reaped the benefits. So I think that people at this stage have a lot of time, a lot of testing, and a lot of knowledge in that space and understanding how people use Apple apps, their characteristics, what they need to perform. Whereas Android, people might be still kind of figuring it out, which I think is in some of those stats. I also feel like maybe what's playing into this as well is when you're developing rich media and ads, one of the things that makes Android a bit more difficult is the variety of devices. So with Apple, yes, the new iPhone 5 has a different resolution and slightly different hardware, but for targeting Apple devices, you don't have to build in too many variances. There's not too many. Whereas when you get into the Android space, there is a wide range of screen size, resolution, quality of screens, all these things that make a big difference when you're doing advertising generation, where I think that's kind of playing into the metrics as well. I think that Android in the long term, it'd be in their best interest to maybe do some consolidation to help the space, not only in obviously the advertising space, which we work within, but also just in the quality of the operating system itself. But I think that's kind of what's laying behind those numbers. But it is interesting to see that ads within applications do so much better than web pages, because right, it's almost counterintuitive, because I would think that you potentially get more clicks in an ad, but they might be accidental. But the research that you were talking about was talking about conversions on a whole and revenue that was getting generated. So not only are people clicking more ads, which I could maybe see accidentally, but it's actually meaning real dollars into the advertiser's pocket, which was something that was a tad bit surprising to me. So when you're looking to purchase some media, really look at the mix at how you're spending those monies, maybe do some testing with applications versus websites, how your designs might need to change between those, and also take some time and invest in rich media development, because the research clearly indicates that the effort is paying off. I think it was 1.7 per times higher click-through rates.
Yeah, it varies across all the platforms, but essentially, yes, you're looking right at multiples mm-hmm. every time you...
And I think that's a little intimidating for some people. Like, how do I build an animated element? I mean, AdWords and Bing have their own builders that are actually pretty good at this point. You might need to create some assets, whether that's backgrounds or buttons or things like that. But, you know, building an animated ad at this point is really not all that difficult. And at the worst, get on Odesk or Freelancer and throw down a couple $100 and get some ads made from a Flash professional. It's really not that big of a deal. And like you said, the research bears out that the differences could be quite huge. So keep that in mind when you're targeting mobile devices. So turning our attention over to email, I quickly wanted to talk about MailChimp put out a good blog post today where they were talking about the new Gmail. For those that don't use Gmail, they've gone through a lot of changes recently, both in how the application looks when you open it up on a browser. So they've introduced these new tabs, which you can control in your settings. But by default, there's promotions, and I believe social is one of the tabs. There's a couple other ones that you can create and interact with. But what Gmail is essentially trying to do, from what I kind of extrapolate from the design, is to, over time, get you to a priority type of inbox, to where what comes into your inbox is what's really important to you. And they're trying to filter out the noise of things that you might want to put attention to later on in the process or when you have time. So emails from Facebook, emails from fab.com or all your Groupons or things like that, those go into separate filters. What comes into your inbox is what's super important and what needs your attention when it comes in. And then we're going to put all this other stuff in tabs where when you have the time to dedicate to it, you can interact with it. Well, what that means for people that are in the space is, you know, Gmail now is effectively proactively filtering out your content potentially. So what MailChimp was talking about in this blog post is they've seen over their platform a full percentage point, in some cases a little bit higher, lower open rates for emails, because a lot of people that run e-commerce stores or lead gen sites that send out mail to their list, now their mail is not going to technically the inbox anymore. It's going into these tab type designs. What was really interesting about this blog post, though, is this account manager whose name escapes me, but he's actually done quite a bit of testing on this to try to trip up Gmail to see if there's any kind of tips or tricks that are some takeaways to essentially force email into that primary inbox, because that's where people's eyes are going to be. And unfortunately, he hasn't really found a good way to do it. In fact, he says in his blog post, Gmail is actually really good at what they do. And I've played around with header designs. I've played around with subject lines, how I'm arranging these emails. And nothing really seems to work consistently to get people into the inbox and skip over these label associations. So I wanted to point that out this week. If you've noticed that your emails have taken a decrease in performance, it might be because of your Gmail segment now performing quite a bit differently because your emails are going into a different place. So for practical tips, I don't know. I mean, that's going to be up to you how you want to communicate, whether that is, you know, sending out a specific email, kind of instructing people to maybe create a rule to send you to a primary inbox, or you just kind of accept this as the new reality, or you do some testing to try to see if you can get into that primary inbox. Kind of the road is up to you. But did want to point that out because I know for my friends that work in the email space, it's been a really big deal for them and something that's been quite noticeable. So wanted to point that out. Check it out, MailChimp's blog. It's quite a good article and might be worth your time to read and understand what's going on in that space.
Yeah, it's an interesting new feature. I enabled it on my account in the last week or so. And just seeing things that I've noticed is, you know, sort of like you're right, they're good at what they do. Every single promotional email I have gotten in the last week has been auto-filtered for me. And I think that, you know, I don't want people to sort of overlook how important this is. I think it's going to drastically change open rates and interaction rates with email lists. I think it's really going to decrease the value of email lists if this continues to roll out to a lot of Gmail users as a default setup. I think it's easy to just go over to that promotions tab and just select all and delete all.
Yeah.
And you don't have to worry about, oh, there was an email from my friend in there, because those are pretty good and pretty much all promotional emails that you can get rid of.
Yeah, I mean, I think you face the mass deletion like you talked about, but also I think your competition now is rising. You know, now you're competing against all the other promotional emails, not just the other inbox. So I think it's really going to separate the boys from the men, ladies from the women, on who can create really good emails that engage people and get them to click on and get them onto their website. Because it's going to be more important now, in my opinion, that you get people off of email and into your websites and engage them, because now your competition is kind of increasing, because you're now in a realm, in a spot in the inbox where you're competing against all the other sales, you know, lead gen, all these other type of promotional emails that might get lumped in together. So competition might get a little bit more fierce. So keep that in mind. All right. So for the last topic tonight, Rob was going to tell us a little bit more about the negatives as positives. Vagaries.
Yeah. So this is more, I guess, maybe like a theoretical. We've been talking about a lot of stats and interesting things tonight, but it's more like a theoretical take on ways you can sort of promote your brand and the voice you can have on your websites. And I think we talked a couple episodes back maybe about some different ways you can do some of this stuff. And I think with the way that the web is sort of going now is I think there's so much opportunity for having a real voice online. You don't need to have that corporate feel for everything you do. You can talk personally to people, and that opens up some new opportunities that I think are a little interesting and different. And sort of what made me got thinking on this sort of using negatives as positives is, you know, the classic interview technique of asking someone, you know, what's your worst attribute or what's your worst trait? And then people say something, you know, that's...
I work so hard that I put in 80 hours a week and my bosses all love me and fight over me. Something
right.
along those
yeah,
lines.
Yeah, right. So they use something terribly cliche and they try to spin it around into something positive. But I think you could actually take that principle and use it online in some interesting ways that I necessarily... I don't know, haven't really seen anyone use. So here's some examples of sort of what I'm thinking about when I'm saying negatives as positives. So saying, you know, like leading with a headline that says, we're not the cheapest, but our service is 5 stars rated by all of our customers. So leading with something that's, you would never hear somebody say, basically you're saying we're expensive, but you know, you get the customer service, you get what you pay for. Here's another example. We don't have 100 features, only the 10 that you need. So I think you've maybe seen some brands lead with, we're simpler than everyone else. You know, our competitors
yeah,
are complex.
37 Signals comes to mind.
37 Signals. Yeah. They're a good example of sort of taking that lead, but I don't think they use direct headlines like that, which I think speak to people in certain situations, especially if you know your channels, if you know people they're getting there from a specific email sort of campaign, maybe that's got a headline that closely ties to this. And you're speaking to people who, you know, maybe have problems with too many features and just need the simple stuff. Leading with a headline like that, I think could have a huge impact and definitely speak directly towards people.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of luxury goods, obviously, that get sold on the internet. And even in those spaces, I don't find people explicitly coming out with that sort of phrasing or headlines. And I feel like a lot of people are just really scared that as soon as you cross the bridge where you tell people that you're not the cheapest, that they're going to leave and go somewhere else. That everyone online is bargain hunting. If you do anything to disrupt that thought process, that you're going to lose people. And you know, as a practical example, one of the companies that I work for sells sports merchandise. Now, we do not sell the cheapest merchandise because of our licensing agreement. So we, for some of the websites that we run, sell official licensed sports memorabilia, which is not the cheapest. You can go on eBay, you can go on counterfeit sites, you can go on Amazon and get cheaper goods that look very similar. The difference is the quality of the good. It's an official licensed product. There's quality control. You know, it's going to hold up better in washes. It's going to be sewn right. It has a warranty, all these types of things. But when I have pitched that internally or talk about those types of elements, it makes people so scared internally because, again, we're going against the grain and not telling people that we're the cheapest, and that there is a real fear that any time that we deviate from this message that you're getting the cheapest products, that people are just going to leave. And I think that you have to give people a little bit more credit that they understand what quality is. And maybe you don't reach everyone now, but the people that you do reach are potentially more likely to buy because they understand the value of what you have to sell them. And what does that look like from a practical standpoint? You know, maybe on our product pages, we show people an element. What is the difference between our jerseys versus X jerseys? We are not the cheapest. That is a fact. But here's what you get with ours. Here's what our jersey looks like after 20 washes. Here's what it looks like on Amazon after 20 washes from this buyer. This is the tangible difference that you get with our goods, where we are not necessarily price competitive, but we are selling you a quality good that it's going to last you. So I am surprised that I don't see more of that, but I think it's just again, this indoctrination of being so price competitive online that if you ever deviate away from that, people are just going to leave in a mass exodus from your site.
Well, thinking about it, it seems kind of ballsy. I mean, I feel if I saw a website who did that, I would be like almost sort of laughing while reading it, like sort of impressed.
Well played.
But, you know, when you think about when you ask friends for advice on things or hey, you know, I saw you just got that new car. Like, what do you think about it? Oftentimes you'll hear people say, well, you know, it's not cheap, but, you know, I love it. Like, it has all these nice features and all this stuff. And, you know, there's those sayings, you know, you get what you pay for. If websites that had good quality products led with headlines like, yeah, we're not cheap, but people love us, and then had a bunch of social networking profiles and look how many people follow us, look at testimonials we have from people, I think outright saying, yeah, we're not cheap, but, you know, obviously we make good products and people love us and people are willing to pay that price, I think that's huge.
We've talked about it before on the show as well, and I feel like there is a cost to going after cheap people. You know, when you are always trying to market and put your stuff off on 20% off or your daily deals or running sales all the time, you know, what type of demographic are you really grabbing at that point? And are they going to be long-term customers? Or are you kind of just grabbing the deal hunter crowd? And what does that do for your brand and your customer base, essentially? And what are you crafting? You know, is your time better spent maybe going after those really loyal customers that aren't necessarily the ones that are always looking for the promo code, always looking for that deal email, but are really fanatical about your brand and the products that you spend your time developing because they are really high quality. It is ballsy, like you talked about, but I expect more people to go after that because there's quite a few verticals where that really makes sense. So I think we've beat that one up quite a bit. Again, thank you for spending your time with us. This has been episode number 18 of The Bearded Marketers. Give us a call, 904-270-9603. What are you struggling with as an online marketer? What would you like us to cover? Between Rob and I, we have quite an eclectic mix of skills and experiences. And if you've struggled with it, we probably know someone or have dealt with it personally. Let us know what we should talk about next episode. But until next time, this has been Rob and Corey, and we are the Bearded Marketers. We'll see you next week.